Welcome back to Cinema Submarine, a film podcast with Ben Cockell. I am your host, and this is the final episode in the Foodie Favorites miniseries. We're covering The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover today by Peter Greenaway. This is one of my favorites, and I got to talk about it with my dear friend Sasha Argarov, who's a super talented director. He was also the guest on last week's episode where we covered Delicatessen. We watched these two films as a double feature, sort of thematically linked by their shared cannibalism. I really hope you enjoy this conversation, and stay tuned because pretty soon I'm going to be announcing what the new miniseries is going to be about. So stay tuned to Cinema Submarine, and I really hope you enjoy this conversation. Thank you. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover is a 1989 film by British director Peter Greenaway. It was his sixth feature film after making A Zed in Two Knots and The Draftman's Contract before this. It tells the story of Georgina, a woman married to a despicable mob boss named Albert Spica. Every night, Albert, Georgina, and Albert's criminal entourage dine at a restaurant called La Hollandaise, where he talks nonstop, chews with his mouth open, assaults his comrades, and abuses Georgina. She sits silently and endures. She bides her time, waiting to get rid of this man. One day, she sees a shy bookseller named Michael dining alone. She falls in love with him. They engage in a scandalous affair in the restaurant bathrooms every night, all with the threat of Albert's rage hanging over them. It takes a long time for them to even speak to each other, and the only person who knows about the affair is Richard, the French head chef of this establishment. When Albert finds out about the affair, he tracks down Michael and kills him in the most gruesome fashion, stuffing him with the torn-out pages of his beloved books. Georgina finds his body and plots revenge. She bides her time. She enlists the help of Richard. The plan is to take out Albert's men and get him alone. Then Georgina will force him to eat a beautifully prepared meal. Her dead lover Michael's body, cooked to perfection by Richard. After he's finished, she shoots him dead and the film ends immediately. It is a bizarre and sadistic revenge tale, full of beautiful sweeping shots, and accompanied by an ever-repeating string score by Michael Nyman. Almost every shot is at a remove and looks like a Baroque painting. The whole movie is drenched in red. Despite its brutality and all of its gross-out moments, it is a deeply lonely and melancholy film, and a satisfying revenge story on top of all that. It's one of Sasha and I's favorites. Okay, and we are back at it again with part two of the Cinema Submarine Cannibalism double feature with Sasha Argarov.
Here I am.
What movie are we covering now?
Fuck. The Cook, the Thief. The Cook, the Thief, the... Fuck.
You can't get it. Okay, I'll
no,
do
no,
it.
No, no,
I'll
no,
do
no.
it. Okay.
I, no, I need
okay,
to do
okay,
this.
Okay.
The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Yeah, you nailed it. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover by Peter Greenaway.
That's true.
Yeah, absolutely
yeah,
it is.
I swear.
1989, this film was made...
Yep.
It was his sixth feature film.
Oh my god, it was?
Yeah, it was his sixth feature film. And this is wild. He'd made 21 short films before he made his first feature. 21. And then his first feature, The Falls, is over 3 hours long.
I've heard
so
it's unwatchable.
It's just wild that he saved it up, you know? Like, that he'd done 21 shorts, and he was like, all right, and now I punish you with 3 hours.
21 short films? It
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He couldn't even stop at like a nice round number. He couldn't even be like
at 20. No,
yeah.
It was 21.
Yeah.
And then his other films, this isn't in order, but he also did A Zed in Two Knots,
yeah.
The Belly of an Architect,
yeah.
I believe. And then he had Drowning by Numbers,
yeah.
And there was a few more before
The Draftman's Contract.
Yeah, and The Draftman's Contract was number 2.
Yeah.
And so you
oh,
actually yeah.
Oh.
So you actually is one of the reasons why I really wanted to have you on was because you introduced me to Peter Greenaway.
Oh.
You were the first person to introduce me to Peter Greenaway, so cheers to that. And that was with the movie The Draftman's Contract.
Yeah.
which I told you is probably I'm one of the only people who probably sit down with you and watch that movie. Yeah, and we watched it during the pandemic too.
Very true, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
On Zoom, separated.
Best time to watch it.
But yeah, you are the first person to really introduce me to Peter Greenaway. So, when did you first get introduced to Peter Greenaway, and what struck you about his work?
I've only seen The Gentleman's Contract and Cook the Thief, and blah, 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 blah.
Yep, and the one we're covering today, yeah.
Exactly. And I saw Cook the Thief when I was way too young.
Yeah. So that was the first one you saw.
Yeah. And I might have been like 12 or 13 or something.
That's very young for this movie.
Yeah. I kind of went on a kick of like very disturbing movies when I was younger. Because
I was there.
Yeah.
I remember.
I've inflicted it on you.
Yeah.
And I was like, and this was one of them that I read was like really twisted. And so I watched it. And I guess it just, yeah, no, I mean, it completely flew over my head. You know, but it had its effect. It was pretty fucked.
How did you find it? Because right now it's a very hard movie to find.
I pirated it. Yeah.
That's what I had to do as well, and I'm sorry for admitting that on microphone, but I'm a type of guy who actually wants to pay for movies, and I will rent a movie, I will buy a movie on iTunes, I will buy it physically if available. Yeah. I checked all those things, and
but
you can't do that.
If it's impossible,
for me to give you money, then you forced my hand, and I feel like even the filmmaker would be like, it's cool. Like, I want you to appreciate my work if I have not given you an avenue to pay for it.
Exactly.
And they didn't, so I had to.
Yeah.
But,
it sucks, you know? It's like...
It's too bad.
It would really be nice to have, like, proper restorations of his work.
Like a Blu-ray Criterion copy of this would be amazing.
I wonder who holds the rights to it. I don't know.
That's always the factor with these things. Yeah. But this movie, I feel like, is actually so well-known that people would want it. Like, people would want that physical copy of this movie.
You would think? It's... Yeah, it's not, like, a crazy obscure movie.
Not at all.
And... Yeah. No, I mean, it's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
It's just so good. And I really like The Gentleman's Contract as well.
Yeah. What do you love about that movie? Talk a bit about it.
I have no idea how to describe that movie or my enjoyment of it. It's one of the weirdest things I've ever seen. Like,
yeah.
It's just so... It feels like a fever dream.
It does. Correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the plot of it is like a wealthy family hires this artist to come to their home and draw their home from all these separate different angles. Yeah. And he's sort of like the role of a director and kind of is meticulously in charge of all of these portraits. And then eventually, I believe, a dead body is hidden in the midst of one of his renderings.
Yeah.
That happens, I believe.
It's kind of weird that I barely remember the events of that movie.
It kind of doesn't matter.
I remember the score, and I remember the cinematography. And I remember the main character's face. He had a very, like, weird doll-like face. Yeah. And that sticks with me.
And there's a naked man.
There is a naked dude who just, like, is there.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's very much like Barry Lyndon on acid. Like,
and Barry Lyndon's your favorite movie.
It is. So this was also a delight. It feels like very Uncanny Valley, very creepy, but, like... I mean, just the score. I think it's one of the greatest scores ever. Like, Michael Nyman is the guy, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I love that movie. I do. I don't know what I prefer between these two. Probably The Cook, the Thief is like...
It's so much more entertaining to watch that I would choose that.
Yeah. But I will say that The Gentleman's Contract sticks in my head in a weird way. That I don't know, yeah.
It has that Uncanny Valley thing. It also, like, reminded me a little bit of Blow Up.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's like Barry Lyndon meets Blow Up.
Yeah, because there's that thing where it's like, there's a dead body, but it's not really about that. That's just kind of on the fringes.
Yeah.
And also, like, both of those films have gorgeous shots of really open plains of grass.
Yeah, true.
That's another thing they have in common.
Yeah.
But it seems like a lot of the movies that you're really into, like Barry Lyndon, like Draftman's Contract, and like this movie, very painterly. Like, they're very well-composed, painterly kind of, like, open. Like, they take a macro view, like, big wide shot kind of painterly view.
Yeah. I don't know. That's just always been the kind of filmmaking I admire. You know, like, pretty austere and kind of removed, you know?
Yeah. So, like, it's like the director's kind of leaning back and just telling you to witness this.
Yeah. And that's why, like, Mikhail Haneke, I would say, is probably my favorite filmmaker and, like... That's why I really admire his work as well, and you know, it just it requires you to put the pieces together yourself. You know, it's not like spoon feeding you.
Yeah.
But I would never compare like Mikhail Haneke to like Peter Greenaway. Like, they're so different. Like, Peter Greenaway is a maximalist, you know, in what he's doing, right? Like, I mean, just like wall-to-wall score, like so composed, you know. And Mikhail Haneke is like very naturalistic. But they still kind of both have this element of like this very icy remove, but in completely different ways. And it's interesting the way they do that. Like, there's a through line, even though their works are just so different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Peter Greenaway, like, just for the painter connection, like, mm-hmm. he was a painter before being a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Like, that was his thing. And, like, also to connect to the previous film that we'd watched, like, Genet painted and saw himself as a painter even when he was making his movies.
Yeah.
Genet was also an engineer. so he's obsessed with objects, which I think you could see in Delicatessen.
Yeah.
And in this movie, Peter Greenaway, like, he wished he was an architect. Like, he said that if he died and came back in another life, he would have wanted to be an architect.
Makes
and
sense.
It's really interesting how, like, where they come from in their previous passions really informs, like, the movies that they ended up making. Like, all of the painting stuff in Cook the Thief is, like, it's so evident.
It's insane. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, like, everything is, like, a Rembrandt. Like,
yeah.
It's nuts. And I feel like, I don't know, these filmmakers who have, like, more substance to bring other than just, like, having seen a lot of movies, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that, I don't know, I mean, like, Stanley Kubrick was, like, a photographer, Mikhail Haneke was a novelist, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Mikhail Haneke started making movies in his 40s, you know?
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that, I just find it's more interesting than, I don't know, like...
It sucks for us.
Yeah, it does suck for us, yeah.
I know, yeah. I have a similar feeling. Yeah. It's like, can't relate, but...
but
like,
it's sick.
It's cool for you. I love watching it in your work.
Yeah.
Like
and I wish I had that.
Like, Robert Altman was in At War, and, like, I feel like so many of the directors of that period were, like, fought in war.
Oh, yeah.
And then they come back and make stuff, and it's like...
Fucking
our
reasons.
Generation will never have, like,
just
one,
like,
experience.
Oh.
Yeah. It's just interesting to see where different directors approach it from.
Totally.
And, like,
totally.
I mean, from painting, Peter Greenaway did editing, and that's how he got into short filmmaking.
Huh.
So he had kind of an interesting, like...
That's wild.
Yeah. He had an interesting stepping stones on the way to being a filmmaker. And now he does, like, museum curation.
Makes sense.
Like, he's, like, transcended making narrative shit
and
is now just doing, like, installations and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And experimenting.
That definitely makes sense.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because, I mean, like, that's kind of what, like, the Drummond's Contract feels like. Like, it feels the closest you can get to, like, an installation piece with, like, a narrative film, you know?
Yeah, if I walked into, like, an all-black room at the Vancouver Art Gallery and they were just playing the Drummond's Contract, I'd be like, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, this works. So, Peter Greenaway... Like, the first film that he saw that made him want to be a filmmaker was when he was 16, he saw The Seventh Seal. And that was the one that actually, like, got him and was like, okay, this is what I want to do. Do you have, like, a moment like that? Because I can't think of one where it's like, okay, this is the one that made me want to be a filmmaker.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah, I feel like I've been just so immersed that I...
Yeah. I say, like, Mikhail Haneke is my favorite director because, like, I don't have, like, a movie or a moment, really, that I can, like, look back at and be like, that's the one. But the one that sticks out in my memory the most would probably be, like, his work, maybe, like, The White Ribbon or something like that, like, watching it when I was way too young.
You saw Funny Games pretty early, too. You were pretty young when you saw the original Funny Games.
Just, like, way too much fucked up shit as a kid. I guess, like, in a way, I was, like, looking for stuff to shock me, just as, like, this twisted, like, you know, just like, pastime. And then I happened upon movies that were actually, like, substantial.
Really good.
Like, yeah, but just happened to be really screwed up at the same time.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, so there was that. And that, I guess, has kind of informed my taste in terms of, like, extremity. In a big way, it was that remove that you were talking about. Like, that macro approach to narrative that I think is really interesting. And it's not something that we see a lot, you know? I think it's a very risky, you know, to lean away from the audience and not give them what they're looking for and to, like, actively, like, you know, fuck with them. Like,
that's so cool that that was something you were into as a kid, though.
Well, yeah, no, but I don't want to say, like, it, like, there was no, like, element of, like, precociousness to it. It was just, like, you know, like...
Yeah. Well, that's like, what brought you there was the messed up stuff, but then it slowly, like, built in a tolerance and an appreciation for that thing.
Yeah, I guess it was just, like, it just interested me because it was, like, it just wasn't, like, the stuff that I was used to seeing, you know? Yeah. It was, like, it just was different, and it was unsettling, and it was weird. And, like, so I couldn't put a name to it, and, like, I didn't know what it was that was having that effect on me, but it interested me.
That's not something you would have gotten out of, like, film school, I feel, either, because they're trying to, and it makes sense, because they want you to make money. but
and I'd like to make money, too.
Of course, and you will. No, I only said that because, like, that, like, film schools are designed to get you to do that, and so it's like, okay, well, the most marketable thing is a film that, like, engages the audience, that leans towards the audience.
Totally.
So, like, it's so cool that you've been able to, like, create, like, a taste that isn't, that's kind of your own because you followed your own rabbit hole, like, in finding the stuff that spoke to you that wasn't just, like, okay, what's gonna make me the most dough and like connect with people the most.
I guess so. You know, I mean, like, I am desperate for approval. So, like, I still want, I want to make, like, my own twisted, like, I want to follow my own twisted sensibility and still have people, like, love it and admire it.
Everyone wants a hit. Obviously.
But, like, and then I'm disappointed when, you know, like, people are like, you know, just like, what the fuck was that? You know, I'm like, but what? You know, it's like the My Fucked Up Mommy Issues movie didn't do it for you. What? Like, you know, but it's the only thing. It's not just like what I want to do. It's just it's kind of the only thing I know how to do. You know?
Yeah.
So I don't want to make something. So
yeah,
I just keep following that, I guess. You know,
100%, 100%.
Yeah.
His other favorite films. I was just like, I'm always curious to see, like, what are those, like, early film influences of these totally. Directors, like, for Genet in the last one, it was, like, Terry Gilliam, which you can totally see, Jacques Tati, and Sergio Leone, and, like, the film that made Genet want to be a director was Once Upon a Time in the West, and then for Greenaway, it's The Seventh Seal, but his favorite film is Last Year at Marienbad. And he was, like, he thought this, like, stuff like Godard was cool, like, he, like, Godard was definitely someone that was, like, changing the game, which he respected, but Renier and Last Year at Marienbad was his favorite movie. And then he got his cinematographer, Sacha Vierney, from that movie. And that's who shot this one.
Huh.
And who shot all of his movies afterwards. That's and he also shot Belle de Jour for Buñuel.
Oh my God. Okay, good lineup.
Good lineup of
Very
movies.
Very impressive lineup.
Very strong. And Hiroshima Mon Amour he did as well for Renier.
Okay.
So... Heavy hitter. Heavy hitter. And you share his name.
So, yeah.
Different spelling, but you share his name.
Exactly. And we're both dudes named Sasha.
Yeah, exactly. Both dudes named Sasha.
Just saying.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Very cool. Very cool.
My kind of
okay.
Guy.
Now let's dive properly into the movie that we are talking about.
Let's go.
Where to start? There's so much to talk about on this one.
It's just insane.
Let's just start with Michael Gambon.
The guy who's talking for, like, 90%.
I feel like that's the most immediate thing to talk about is Michael Gambon's performance in this movie and what an absolute powerhouse it is.
Oh, my God. I mean, he's just hitting the same note the whole time.
Why is it not boring? It's so
it's
good
weird,
the whole
right?
time.
Like, you're... Like, I'm into it. Like,
yeah.
It could be so annoying. And, I mean, it is annoying in a, like, in the way
in
it's
an intentional way, yeah.
But, like, it... It doesn't make me want to stop watching.
He's one of the worst characters of all time. He's truly a horrible,
no
horrible person.
No redeeming qualities whatsoever.
Unbelievable that he can be the twinkly-eyed Dumbledore.
nuts.
And later on in his career, nuts. That is a range.
Yeah,
that is a range.
They watched that movie. They watched Cook the Thief.
And this is our guy.
Yeah, Dumbledore.
This is the grandfather of a generation.
Honestly,
this guy.
Come on, let's do it.
Yeah,
like that's pretty cool.
It's so cool growing up on Harry Potter for me. Like that's such a foundational thing for me. And then like watching like Mike Lee movies and seeing like the whole cast of Harry Potter just being monsters.
True.
Just like horrible, or like in Bruges and seeing the cast of Harry Potter also be monsters. It's just fun to be like, oh, they picked the best actors ever from the country.
And just
at that time,
be so wholesome.
And like, I mean, obviously like Ralph Fiennes isn't wholesome, but like.
Yeah.
In it's like just so different.
Yeah,
it's a different thing.
Nuts. It's nuts.
So cool because I feel like they're childhood friends, and then I see them doing this stuff, and I'm like, wow,
that is not what I grew up like.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
That's nuts.
The
yeah.
amount of lines Michael Gambon had to memorize in this movie is unholy.
Oh my god! Like, I wonder if there were. I feel like there probably wasn't improv. Like,
just because Peter Greenaway is so exacting.
Yeah, and like those. I mean, like, those compositions and the way the camera's moving, it's just so precise.
Yeah.
You
have exactly 4 seconds to improvise here, so.
Yeah, go.
That's
just
great.
Go off.
That's great.
Yeah. No, it's, I don't know how anybody does that. Just like, oh my god.
So much prep. It'd be like doing a play.
Yeah.
It'd be just like doing a play.
Well,
like,
it's very theatrical, you know?
Super
the
theatrical.
Very theatrical, but in a way that, like, usually if somebody told me that, I would be like, I don't want to see that movie. Like, that's not what I'm interested in. But it works. Like, it just works.
It totally works. Yeah. I think both of the movies we're talking about have, like, a ton of, like, style and artifice, but for some reason...
Yeah.
And, but for this movie in particular, that doesn't keep me away from, like, the emotional drama of it.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah,
the horror
weird,
of it, too.
Yeah.
Like, even though you don't believe for a second that this is a real place you could go to, that doesn't make it any less... horrifying when the abuse that happens in this movie happens, because there's a lot of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's funny because with like Delicatessen, it feels artificial, but it doesn't feel artificial in the same way where it's like that's a very heavily stylized movie, but it still feels like the world within the world that the movie takes place in. It feels real. Like,
it feels lived
in.
It feels scuffed up.
Yeah.
This really feels like a soundstage that is just immaculately designed.
Yeah. It's like the second, like, if the camera, like, turns in the other direction, like, you know, it opens up and the whole...
You'd
like,
see the crew and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, that feeling is always there, but you're still, like you said, like, it's very emotionally engaging.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. Like, I read, like, Ari Aster talking about this movie, and he says, like, this is, like, one of his primary influences, right? Peter Greenaway.
Mm-hmm.
And like he took that, like he was talking about how that artifice was something that really disturbed him when he saw it, and how he wanted to apply that in the same way to his films. And I think like it's definitely not as...
But Hereditary, like even like think about that opening shot where it goes into that dollhouse and stuff, like that is like the filmmaker being the spectator to a play kind
of.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it feels very, like a lot of the movie feels very dollhouse and like very removed.
There's so many different elements that are always like going throughout this movie. We were even talking about it while we were watching it. It's like there's almost no time in this movie that isn't either the incredible Michael Nyman score, a weird wispy Luna Lovegood child singing opera, Michael Gambon swearing, or like... awkward sex.
Yeah.
That pretty much is like wall to wall what's going on in
Helen
this movie.
Mirren, pretty hot.
Yeah, I think
can't
we can
believe,
all agree.
Yeah, can't
we can all agree.
I would say that because I just know Helen Mirren is like...
Well, yeah, again, another person like Dumbledore where it's like, okay, I see you as like a grandmother, and then like the revelation of Michael Gambon being horrible and Helen Mirren being hot is a cool thing
I'll
that
never
this movie
look
has.
At Helen Mirren the same way.
I'm,
or Michael
and
Gambon.
I'm glad.
Yeah,
I'm glad.
No, me too. Oh my god. Like, I don't know. And I mean, just the way it starts out, just like the opening scene is like a guy getting the shit beaten out of him,
and then actual
shit
smeared on him, which was chocolate mousse, by the way. I found out behind
that's
the scenes that was actually chocolate mousse, which makes me feel less bad for that man.
Yeah,
but not, but still pretty bad for him because
he
has to be
like
full
naked.
Frontal.
Yeah.
Like, that man probably has a family,
like,
you know?
Yeah, and, like, pissed on. I mean, like, again, I'm sure they're not, like, actually pissing on the guy, but, like, fake piss.
But still, pretty demoralizing as a performer. You know, it's like, okay, I only have a few days on set every year, and one of them was getting beaten up and pissed on.
I'd do it. Why not?
Yes, you would.
I totally would.
Yes, you would.
That's a story.
For Peter Greenaway.
That's a story. I'd get off on it. Oh, my God.
I wouldn't do it for anyone, but for Peter Greenaway.
For Peter Greenaway, yeah. Like, you 100%. Know, if it was, like, a filmmaker I respected, like, yeah.
Sure. Totally. You're going for it. You're going for it.
Why not?
Absolutely. What of those elements is, like, your favorite part? Like, if you had to pick between, like, the tracking shots or the score, or, I mean, they're so integral. That's kind of an unfair question.
No, I see what you mean.
But what part, like, resonates with you the most of the, like, key DNA of this movie?
I just, yeah, it is, like, I don't know how to separate them. You know?
Yeah, that's why it's a weird question, because they really all are one.
Yeah, like, but that's why that movie stands out to me as, like, such a successful, like, work of art, because, you know, again, like, I can look at Delicatessen, and I can very clearly pull out the things that I like and the things that don't work for me.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas, like, this, you know, yeah, like, I the way he moves the camera is crazy. Like, I love it, you know?
Oh, my God. It's so sweeping. Oh, all those God, tracking yeah. shots. Yeah. And then the score, like, you were saying when we were watching it, you were like, oh, this movie makes me feel, like, weirdly melancholy. And to me, that is in large part due to the score.
Absolutely, yeah.
Without it, the movie just wouldn't be the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I agree 100%. Like, it adds so much. And I'm someone who, like, I'm not crazy about score. Like,
mm-hmm.
I've never made something with a score, and I think a lot of the time it's a crutch.
It'll be interesting when you do, though. I'll be curious to see what you do when you do.
I just want it to be like it has to feel right, and it hasn't felt right. I don't really know how to use it.
I feel like you would use it the way Funny Games uses it. Where it's all
have a score?
No, remember when it just does crazy, like, screamo death?
Yes, metal? Yeah.
That's I feel nice. Like you. It's oh not a score; God. It's just music. Yeah, yeah. But I feel like you would use it like that, where it's like nothing, and then all of a sudden, the most music you've ever heard, so and then good. Nothing again.
Oh my God! Yeah, that would be sick.
Yeah,
but like I, like Peter Greenaway, he has score like wall to wall. But like I really admire that. Like it doesn't feel like it's. Trying to, I don't know how to put this.
It doesn't manipulate.
Yeah, like it feels like it's creating an atmosphere, but it's not trying to like bring, like it's not trying to add emphasis to moments in the narrative that like that the emphasis isn't already there. It's like it plays the same role as the production design, you know, it's like the wallpaper in the background or, you know, all the props or the costumes or, you know, it's like, it's just another thing. And I really admire it in that way because it's not commenting on the action. It's just kind of there and it's creating this subconscious feeling, you know?
It does that same thing that you were just talking about that you love with your favorite directors where it creates that kind of remove. Like, it does that too.
Yeah.
Because it's just kind of ever-present and it kind of lulls you into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
But I also think it brings out the lonely. Because these characters are so lonely, even Michael Gambon, why do you think he's filling up all that dead air? Like, that's a profoundly lonely person who wants kids.
True.
And when they even mention that, like, he doesn't have kids, he breaks down into tears in one of the best moments.
Oh, my God.
And then... Georgina, utterly lonely
with
this man who never stops talking. Michael, the lover, super lonely, just like living around all these books, having dinner by himself.
Yeah.
And even the cook, like, I mean, we don't see him. He seems like he has he seems the least lonely, but he also seems like he has a hellish existence.
He seems pretty lonely.
Being under the thumb of this monster. And also, you know, later, like, Georgina and Richard, the chef, like, they have that conversation about, like, did you like watching us when we were, like, making love in your kitchen? Yeah. And, like, did you want to be a part of it? And there is kind of the sense that, like,
totally.
In a way, he was hiding it because he wanted to feel complicit in it in some way.
Yeah.
So they're all pretty lonely, and I think the score really brings that out.
Totally. You know? Yeah, yeah. It, all these lonely people. It hits, like, this emotional register. In a way that doesn't feel manipulative, but, like, it brings out another layer of emotion that wouldn't be there without it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a crazy scene, though, went with Richard and Georgina, that really long two-hander they have in the kitchen.
Like, I want you to cook my lover. Like,
my dead lover, yeah.
My God, so nuts.
It goes through, like, so many insane turns and somehow earns it because that's the movie it's been to this point.
Yeah.
Like, she offers sex in return for cooking her dead lover.
And it's like, yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's a tactic that she makes would sense. Use in this situation.
Yeah,
100%. And she tries to, that's like, get him to admit to enjoying being like a voyeur to her own sexual endeavors in this kitchen.
Yeah.
And you're like, and
sense.
The whole scene is a misunderstanding where he thinks that she wants to cook him to consume him herself, but then when she says the flip is, no, I'm doing this to punish your boss, he's like, I'm doing it. That's
he's
great.
He's like, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's an insane, like, you couldn't pitch that as a two-hander.
No.
But it works.
It totally works. Because you're completely under the spell of this movie by the end of it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
It's weirdly sad at times, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It leaves you with a very sad feeling.
Like, just some of the... That scene in particular that really, like, almost brought me to tears was the scene where her lover's dead and she, like, goes and, like, tucks herself into bed with him.
Yeah. Because
that's something you could relate to. It's like, oh, my God, that's the worst feeling. Like, if you loved someone and they were gone and then you're, like, just going to pretend for one night. Like, that didn't happen. And in the morning, that's everything's going to change.
Yeah.
Like, that is crushing.
Yeah.
And in a movie with that much remove, to have a moment that, like, is really that impactful.
That, yeah.
And it's not just, like, he's, like, died in his sleep. Like, he's naked next to her.
Murdered.
And he's been stuffed with pages from books, which is one of the most inventive and messed up ways I've seen someone killed.
Oh, my God. Peter Greenaway is fucking twisted.
Yeah, but it never feels like... Yeah. Mean or like exploitive to me, like maybe mean, but it doesn't feel like I don't get the energy that I'm being used as an audience member, like that he's just getting off.
No, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
Even as messed up as it is,
it's
nihilistic and mean spirited
in a way that I like, though.
Yeah, there's just
it does still feel human.
I don't recoil from it, though, for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like a director with a mean streak, as long as there's still that empathy and that humanity underneath it. Like, it's not just, like, empty provocation, you know? And, like, even, when it is mean or when it is cruel, like, at the end of the day, it's still a means to an end that is very, like, emotional and is actually trying to do something with that rather than just, like, torture porn.
Yeah, it has melancholy. It can be, like, I wouldn't call it necessarily sexy because it's so weird.
Yeah.
But, like, it has that kind of, like, there's a kinky energy to the movie.
Totally.
There's, like, a kink that runs throughout it.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't just have that one note of, like, it just being brutal or boundary pushing. Like,
it's
it has
all
a lot
over.
Going on.
Yeah. No, it's great. Yeah. I love this movie.
It's a great movie. I'm so glad we got to talk about this one.
100%.
And, like, Helen Mirren is so good in it. And it's
everyone.
A hard task.
Oh, yeah.
Because Michael Gambon's...
She's also the quiet, like, victim in a way.
Yeah.
But at the end, she becomes someone with a lot of agency, but...
She has to hold this movie as the main character and, like, hold the movie with silence.
Oh, yeah.
That's tricky.
There's so much that goes unsaid because she'll get the shit beaten out of her.
Yeah.
She says it, you know, it's
But she's the audience. Like, we are connected with her throughout all this tension.
Totally.
As, like, this quiet spectator. And I think that's why the remove thing works now that I'm thinking about it. Like, you're in the tension of her shoes. So even though you're, like, really physically far away from her with where the camera is placed, like... You have this, like, empathy connection to her and that tension of, like, at any point he can snap and just, like, kill her.
Yeah.
Like, he could do that.
Yeah. Every time she goes to the bathroom to fuck that dude, it's like...
It's so tense.
When's it gonna happen?
When's it gonna blow up?
Yeah.
And you know it will, because you've seen the mean streak that this director has.
Exactly.
In the first scene, you see the mean streak. So you're like, okay.
This is not...
Chekhov's gun is on the wall.
Yeah.
And it's not like he hasn't used it already.
Yeah,
like, he shot a few people with the gun.
Yeah.
So
when's
it gonna go off next?
So,
and it goes off.
Yeah.
It really
goes
off. Until it's turned on him. And it's so satisfying when it is.
Oh my God.
It's
what
so good. Such a good climax. So
wild.
Satisfying.
Yeah.
I mean, he's such a horrible person the whole film that when he finally gets his comeuppance, it's really satisfying.
And it's interesting. I just thought, like, again, you know, most movies have the climactic moment, and then, you know, you have the denouement, like, right after for, like, 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
But this movie ends, like, right on the climax.
Yeah.
Like, it, there is no resolution. It's like...
She shoots him, he falls off his chair, and we fall. End.
Yeah, and that's it. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare. I like that. Yeah. Especially for a movie of that length. Like, it's not... Well, it's not... I mean, it's not a super long movie, but it's not a short one either.
No.
You know?
And it's because, like, it has that... elongated tracking shot score feel, like, totally. It takes its time. Totally. It's not rushing totally. You anywhere, so yeah. You feel the length of
it's not boring.
Not boring, but it's not fast.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
So it's cool that it just ends like that, and it kind of has that, like, okay, well, the climax has been reached, and that is
we're
it.
Out.
That is it.
Yeah.
There's no more to say now.
Yeah.
Which one of the characters was your favorite of our lead four?
The chef is fucking...
The chef?
Know, there's something
he gets the least time in a way, but also he's a solid dude in the midst of
all this.
He seems
like a nice guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, Michael Gambon is, like, so... I mean, he's the most memorable.
It's so showy.
Yeah. But it's funny No, absolutely, yeah. It's funny because every single one of those characters I find to be very memorable.
Yeah.
Like, Helen Mirren, like, I'll... You know, her character is, I mean, she's the movie, like you said.
Yeah.
And even, like, Michael the Lover, like, I find him to be very memorable as well. Like, he's just such a nice guy.
He's
and,
a
like,
really sweet guy.
Yeah.
And they didn't cast some beefcake.
Yeah.
They,
for
like,
this
cast
erotic movie.
A
like,
really normal looking guy.
Yeah, just like an average British dude.
Yeah.
And, like, he's great. Like, I find him very memorable. Like,
yeah.
He's kind of the, I mean, their relationship is the heart and humanity of this movie, right? But even the fact that, like, the chef is still, like, a very empathetic character as well, like, it has that empathy that is just so necessary for a movie like this, you know?
Another thing that I also really like is that, oh my god, what's that character's name? Michael, the lover. I like that he and Georgina, like, don't speak for the majority of
the
beginning of the movie.
Half. Awesome.
First half of the movie, they don't speak, which is a really cool contrast to Michael Gambon, who's always talking. I just love...
Yeah.
I feel like that's so well written, to just have that contrast in there.
Very true, yeah.
I really like that about it. And I also have this piece of trivia, which I thought was really cool.
Heavy.
So he originally named all of the characters after the actors that he wanted for the roles, which is a risky endeavor, for sure.
Yeah.
So... Albert Spica, who is the Michael Gambon's character, was originally going to be Albert Finney, who couldn't do it. So the part was named after Albert Finney. And Michael was originally supposed to be played by Michael Gambon.
Really?
Yeah. And then they switched
that
his role.
So
Albert
weird.
Finney dropped out. So Michael Gambon got Albert, and they got Alan Howard to come on to play Michael. Georgina Hale was supposed to be Georgina, and then she dropped out, or maybe she just was never attached, because he just, like, put his dream cast in the list, and so then Helen Mirren took her part, and then Richard Borst played Richard, the chef, so he's the only guy who ended up having the same name, but that's kind of a funny game of chess that they all played.
Like, Michael Gambon as...
As the lover would have been so weird. It's hard to imagine now.
Well, because he's just so the character that he played.
Yeah.
Like, and he's got that big brooding figure, you know, and like, and the guy who was cast, you know, he's just so kind of slender and like harmless, you know, it's like, I can't imagine.
I'm very glad it ended up the way it did, honestly,
but
it's very cool that that was,
I mean, Albert Finney would have been great, but it is weird that, like, you have these two big, bulky guys, and, like, I like the contrast between, like, Michael Gambon is, like, the scary, fucking, you know, like, abusive husband, and then you have Michael, who's the,
Yeah, I think it's very necessary to have, you know...
Totally.
...that difference in there. One of the paintings that really inspired this movie is the painting on the mural in the back of that restaurant. So he was just like, I'm just gonna put my influence...
Just
on a pedestal,
there.
Okay, there we are. You should just put Barry Lyndon posters in all the movies for that exact reason.
Yeah.
What are your top three gross out moments?
In the movie?
Yeah.
Or in general?
Not in general, in the movie. we don't want to horrify the listeners.
Dog shit.
At the beginning, yeah, course. that's definitely...
Eating the corpse.
Like, yeah, eating Michael.
Bookended, you know,
yep.
Come on. There's just so many gross-out moments in that movie. It's such
yeah,
a nasty
really
movie.
Is. It's a pretty nasty movie, yeah.
Which I love, because it's, like, on the surface, it's, like, this austere, like, European art house movie, but it's, like, nasty. I mean, like, just the scene where he's, like, force-feeding him the books is, like...
That's pretty nasty. That's
pretty
definitely...
Rough.
I would agree with that top
yeah,
three.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, that... It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Did you ever get annoyed by the opera kid? Really interesting cast
yeah.
and like character
verging but never quite like
yeah
it yeah sometimes it was a little much,
but then like they abuse him so terribly that then I
yeah.
just feel bad for him.
They went for it. Oh,
they really hurt that kid.
They like Peter Greenaway doesn't give a fuck.
No, you really don't get this. And that's a guy, I mean, he had four kids, but you don't get any sense that
yeah.
he does the way he treats that kid.
I get like I feel like he just attacks random people on the street. Like, that's
he's such like a he's such like a I mean in interviews he's just such an articulate
yeah.
British classy dude,
but
so
he has to be a maniac somewhere down deep.
Maybe he just puts it all in the work.
I love that. I mean like
yeah.
I love watching a movie that feels like it was made by someone who was insane. Like
yeah.
I think that is so exciting. Like
yeah.
when you watch a movie and you're like whoever made that has to be genuinely disturbed. Like how often do you get that? You know, that's great.
Not all the time.
Yeah.
When you do, it is special, though.
It is, right? It's like...
It is special.
Whoever made this is disturbed, and now whatever is wrong with them is rubbed off on me, and, like, I'm not gonna let this go.
I sometimes equally love the exact opposite of it, where you watch a film and you're like, this was a movie made by someone who was very well. Like, usually it's somewhere in the middle,
yeah.
and it's not, but if you, like, watch a movie by, like, someone like Ozu or Jacques Tati
True.
Or Miyazaki or
True.
Something,
yeah.
or
yeah.
Renoir,
True.
Like, that
yeah.
have, like, this, like, big-hearted warmth in it.
True.
It's also
yeah.
nice to watch one where you're just like, wow,
this feels
like,
good.
Like, this person's, like, humanity and soul shining through. Then a lot of the time you learn a little bit more about them, and you're
True.
Like, oh, no,
yeah,
Jacques
yeah,
Tati was
yeah.
a total taskmaster and was
nice.
Yelling at everyone and was meticulous.
Oh,
and,
great, yeah.
But it's also nice to, like...
Just feel
like oh, wow.
Cool.
Yeah. Most movies exist in the middle, where you
yeah.
feel like, okay, this person isn't particularly disturbed, and they're not particularly well-adjusted.
They're just somewhere.
They're just somewhere in the,
yeah.
in the middle.
Yeah. yeah.
But it's cool when you can feel either end of that spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot more fun to binge movies by people who are not okay, though. It's way
yeah.
more fun.
I mean, I just I love feel bad movies and like
feel good movies are great as gifts to yourself.
Yes, definitely.
But I can watch way more feel bad movies in a row.
Yeah, and like there's a weird satisfaction I get from them that I don't get from anything else. Like I get a very different satisfaction from like good feel good movies, not
yeah.
like sentimental, like annoyingly sentimental or like
yeah.
manipulative feel good movies, but genuinely feel good movies.
Yeah.
Those are fantastic and I'll always have a place in my heart for those.
Yeah.
They're not gonna be the things I make.
One other question I wanted to ask you was the color red, very important in this
yes.
movie. The color red is everywhere.
Yeah.
I have a list of some of my favorite films that are like red.
Yeah.
That are like all red.
Yeah.
I wanted to see if you can think of any other like red.
Cries and Whispers is
that's
like,
on my list.
I mean, yeah, it's like
it's like
that's like
the
red the
red movie.
Yeah.
yeah.
What
are your favorite red movies?
Oh my god. Three Colors Red.
Yep, that's
yeah.
on my list too. Yeah.
yeah.
I just want to see if you can think of one that I
Deep
haven't.
Red.
yeah, that's on my list.
Lots of red.
Deep Red and Suspiria
yeah.
are both on
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Suspiria's got a kaleidoscope of colors, but it has a
yeah.
lot of red. A
lot of red.
Yeah. You've got up most of the main ones. We talked about one of them.
We did.
In the Mood for Love.
Oh.
Ton of red in the Mood for Love.
Yeah, true.
There's that one shot where like they're in between the bathroom and the dining room in Cook the Thief, and it kinda almost looks like a shot from In the Mood for Love.
True.
The way they're like not talking and
true.
Like it's like intimate but they're distant and it's
yeah.
all red and there's the sweeping
yeah.
score. I was like, oh, this
very
is kinda
much,
like
yeah.
In the Mood for Love here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the other one, I really like the use of red in Don't Look Now, with that red raincoat.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, 100%.
That's not like a red movie, but that like one drop of red is so awesome.
True.
And the red room in Videodrome also, I like.
Yeah.
With the like weird gooey wall that's red.
Yeah. And I was thinking like the bathroom and The Shining or something.
Okay, yeah. Well, The Shining has a lot of good red.
Yeah.
The Shining's a very red movie.
I like.
Might be the best color on camera.
Yeah. Dude, red is a very rich, like.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think like what else like a very red movie, like Evil Dead or something.
Evil, yeah. There's so a lot of red horror movies. God, yeah.
Yeah.
Evil Dead is pretty red. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them.
Good question though.
It's a weird one. I mean, Carrie at one moment is pretty red.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. Yeah.
Any movie that has blood raining.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is a pretty red movie. Yeah. Oh my God. One other fun question is, of the four protagonists, if you had to take one out for a dinner date, or just dinner even, it doesn't have to be a date, like, who would you most want to share a meal with out of those four people?
Michael seems like such a sweetheart.
Yeah.
Come on, dude.
Maybe not the best conversationalist, but very sweet man.
Yeah. You know, and he's well-read. Like, I want to pick
He is well-read. Yeah, I feel like once you'd get him going,
yeah,
then he'd be excellent.
Yeah, yeah. I want to pick that guy's brain.
And you could talk about your loneliness with him. Like, yeah. I think anyone could just bare their soul to that guy.
How about you?
I would probably choose Richard, the chef.
True.
Just because I wouldn't even want to talk that much. I would just want him to prepare me a meal and talk me through it.
True.
Like, I feel like that'd be such a good night.
Okay. If he's preparing the meal, then
on a date with that chef, like, that's what has to happen, right?
As long as it's not human flesh,
As long as it's not human flesh, I'm in.
Yep, honestly.
Even if.
Why not?
It would just be so cool, like, to have him, like, just talk you through the meal, like, all the little things. Totally. And, like, I just think he'd be an interesting person to pick his brain and ask him about, like, okay, like, who are, like, your wildest customers that, like, aren't Michael Gambon? And, like, you know, like, what are your experiences? You feel
how
like you've seen some shit.
How does that restaurant have any customers?
It's insane that it's packed every night.
How?
When it's just, like, and they even say in the movie, which I think is great, that, like, where else are you going to go eat? No one else will have you.
True.
Like, that's such an awesome, like, thing, because he, like, pretends to be the king and everything, but it's, like, this is actually quite sad, because this is the only place where they'll even let him do his shtick.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have no idea why anyone else is there. That would be the worst place to get dinner. You have to listen to that man.
Oh my God. And probably get assaulted by him at some point.
Oh, horrible. Yeah. Like, and all of his thugs.
Oh yeah.
Like, but Tim Roth's there.
But it's kind of like one of those, like, gimmick restaurants.
Yeah.
It's like, you know? Like, it's like, oh, like Dark Table, it's like you're blind.
Or like what the Elbow Room Cafe used to be, where they, like, the waiters
like
insult you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, why you gotta go? And you, like, get here, one of the biggest crime bosses in the city
just like
berate his wife.
Losing it. Yeah. It's like, damn shit.
Just like, wow, fun. It's like, yeah, my friend died there last year. It's like, what?
You gotta check.
No way, you gotta go.
Oh
like,
my God.
Like, read
this
the Yelp reviews.
All over his plate.
The Yelp reviews are so wild. Like, you gotta go to La Hollandaise.
Honestly,
you gotta
La Hollandaise.
Go.
You
so
remember
good.
The name. That's impressive.
Thank you.
Come on.
Thank you. Good Is there anything else that you like feel like you haven't touched on with this movie?
No,
I feel
God,
like
I
it needs to. I feel like
gamut.
I feel like we've done a lot of the key elements of what makes this thing special.
Yeah.
Like Michael Nyman, obviously incredible.
Yeah.
One of his best scores.
Yeah.
This and the piano.
Yeah. And the drummer's contract.
Yep.
Just gonna say.
He did Gattaca too, which is wild.
And Gattaca has a great score.
It's got a great score. And then he did
Lyman's the GOAT. Like,
and he also collaborated with Damon Albarn from the Gorillaz.
Yes.
Who made Gorillaz. And they did a whole score together.
So wild.
So cool guy.
He's like him. Yeah, he's my favorite composer, I'd say.
Yeah.
But like him and Philip Glass have an interesting like
Yeah, people who aren't just film composers, they like also just like make music and
that, like,
have an artistic life.
Repetitive, like,
Yeah. Well, it'll be cool to see what type of music you have in a movie when it eventually happens. And my final double feature question is, like, if you could take one character from Delicatessen, one character from The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, and like like have them meet and have like a scene together or a spinoff, which two characters would you be interested to see interact?
The Butcher and Michael Gambon.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. Because like Michael Gambon would way outdo that Butcher.
True.
He would like ruin him.
True. But they're both so unlikable.
Yeah.
Like it's just like the two similar most roles in that movie. People. Yeah.
It'd be pretty great to see them together.
Yeah. Two big burly men just being horrible.
Yeah.
That's the name of the next movie.
That's the name of that movie, that's for sure.
Oh my god.
I think it'd be interesting to see like like Tim Roth from The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, like hanging out with, what would be a weird person for him to hang out with in Delicatessen, like the frog guy. I want to see that
one.
One of the troglodytes. And Tim Roth have their own movie.
One of the henchmen. You know.
We didn't even talk about how Tim Roth is in this movie.
He's just in it.
He's just there. And he's good.
He's fine. But I mean, like,
he's just there. Just and same with, like, Kieran Hines is in one scene, and he's just, like, there.
He is?
Yeah.
Who the fuck is Kieran Hines?
He's, like, one of the mob bosses who, like, pisses off Gambon that he attacks.
How did I not even notice that?
I didn't notice it either until I looked at the cast list later. And there's the two Dumbledore brothers fighting. So weird. Because they play brothers, Aberforth Dumbledore and Albus Dumbledore, in one of their earlier encounters, which was less nice.
Oh my god.
I know. Pretty wild. Pretty wild. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a long time coming.
Thank you very much.
And I'm so happy you did it. I'm so happy you committed to a double feature too. Because everyone would do that.
Of course. Come on.
Well, I'm very glad you did.
Let's do it again.
Let's do it again. Absolutely. I think you will be a repeat guest on the podcast. I have a funny feeling.
Hope so.
Because there's like not many people I can talk to like this about movies for this amount of time.
I'm so sorry. The list is people who are listening.
The list is small.
There we go. Okay.
And, like, also, Peter Greenaway once said that, like, he thinks you should watch all of the great movies before you're 21, because then he thinks that your, like, your disbelief, like, your, starts to, like, crack, sort of, like, that you'll just, like, go with the movie unconditionally.
Mm.
And I feel like, of anyone that I know, like, we have tried to do that the hardest.
True.
I feel like that's why you had to be on the podcast, because when I heard that quote, I was like, okay, I definitely haven't seen all the great movies before I'm 21, because no one has.
That's a lot.
But like of the movies. People I know, you are probably the person who has attempted to do that the hardest.
I appreciate it.
So that. Major points to Sasha Argarov. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Cinema Submarine. Cheers. And that is a wrap on the first mini-series of Cinema Submarine. If you've listened to the end of this episode, thank you so much. You are a saint. I really appreciate your support. You can rate it or review it if you're feeling like it. No worries if you don't want to, but it would really help the show. And the show will be returning pretty damn soon, I must say. You may notice that this was a very short season on food-related films. That's because I will be doing a part two at some point. But another film theme was calling my name. It has been calling my name for a long time. I've wanted to do a sort of curated series of films on this topic, but I haven't had the chance to until now. So I'm in the midst right now of recording season two of Cinema Submarine. I've already recorded two episodes, and they've been a blast. I've got three more organized to record, and then there will be more episodes after that. So it's a much longer, more traditionally formatted season of podcast episodes in that they are a lot longer. There will be a wide variety of guests that I'm really excited to share with you. I think that there's a nice balance in the films in season two between some of the more obscure fare that we covered in this first season and some more mainstream films that I think more people have seen and might be interested in. So I think we've got a good balance there. Also, all the films covered in season two are easy to find on streaming services or on YouTube. We do cover some films from America, and I'm excited for you to check out what I've curated because I'm really excited about it. And thank you so much for listening to my show. Whether you're someone who has seen all of these films and was engaged in the conversations, or someone who knows me or has seen me in something and just wanted to hear me talk about movies. However you came to this show, I appreciate you. So
I'm going to drop a little hint at what the next season is going to be about. Stay tuned. It is going to be coming out in May. You can follow me at Ben Cockell on Instagram or at Cinema Submarine on Instagram to find out the details. And have a great rest of your day. Thanks.